This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dan Wolf joins me on the long line. Dan is the founder and the executive director of the International Lifeline Fund. You can learn more online and how you can help at lifelinefund.org. Dan, good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, Coy.
Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. So you are the guy that sued Saddam Hussein. This is a hell of a story. We want to talk, of course, in depth about the Lifeline Fund and the good work you're doing in Africa. But before we do, let's back up for a few years. Give us a Dan Wolf 101, and then I want to talk about the case against Hussein.
Sure, no problem. I'm a lawyer by trade. I've devoted most of my career to the pursuit of human rights and refugee matters, and have done a lot of also class action work on behalf of victims of human rights and civil rights abuses. So I had been approached at one point by a group of American citizens who had been taken hostage by Saddam's security forces following the invasion of Kuwait in 1990. They had been held as human shields at various strategic locations throughout Iraq and Kuwait in order to deter the United States and its coalition allies from taking military action to liberate Kuwait. So that was the nature of the lawsuit against Saddam.
So these people, so you met some of these people?
I've met scores of them.
Yeah. And what are the, for those of us who are just ignorant, what are some of their stories? I mean, what happens? Do they just... I'm assuming these are Westerners, most of them from the West.
They were all American citizens.
All Americans.
That I represented were all American citizens. They were, shortly after the invasion of Kuwait, Saddam ordered his security forces to round up all of the American citizens that they could find. They then forcibly arrested them. They sent them, usually in blacked out buses or cars, to remote locations where there was a oil installation or a dam or a military installation or what have you, and they locked them up, sometimes in chemical weapons facilities. They denied them access to medical treatment. They fed them a starvation diet. In many instances, they were degraded and abused, and in some instances, beaten and tortured. And that's the life they lived of absolute terror, because they were absolutely certain, most of them were absolutely certain, that they would not get out of there alive.
And I guess most of us remember that video footage that came out of Kuwait that showed Saddam Hussein with that little American boy, really creepy images of Saddam sitting there holding the little boy's arm and saying, look, he's healthy, he's fine, these people are fine. And
yeah,
of course, America shuddered, you know, it was just, oh, my God.
That's the enduring image came to symbolize what was going on, but it was obviously a terrifying incident for anybody that was caught up in it. And I can tell you that many of these individuals haven't been able to shake it. I mean, they've been scarred for life as a result of the terror that they experienced.
We're talking with Dan Wolf, the founder and executive director of the International Lifeline Fund, online at lifelinefund.org. So, as a result of working with these people, you had an idea for some legislation, is that right?
Well, yeah. What happened was is that actually, separately, even before I started working with these individuals, I had sponsored legislation, had crafted legislation in the Congress to allow American victims of egregious human rights abuses to sue the terrorist countries that were responsible. Then, following the lawsuit against Saddam and his regime, I again embarked on a legislative effort to basically pass a bill that would enable American citizens who had been terrorized by terrorist countries to enforce any judgments that they have obtained against the blocked assets of those terrorist countries that were present in the United States.
So if a terrorist country uses Americans as human shields, you helped to write and get through legislation in the U.S. Congress that would allow lawyers over here in America to sue on behalf of these Americans.
Sue on behalf, and ultimately, if the terrorist country had assets in the United States, to collect against those assets.
Right. We're talking with Dan Wolf, the International Lifeline Fund. So pick up the story then after 9/11. What happened then to move that forward?
Well, it was interesting. Up until that time, for about a year and a half, the case had sort of was in a kind of suspended animation. It just wasn't moving swiftly. Then about a week after 9/11, Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson called us into his chambers, told us he wanted to move the case swiftly. I said that we could be ready for a trial within a month. And sure enough, he had a trial date open, you know, 3 weeks later, which was faster than I had expected. He called my bluff, and so we went through three very hectic weeks of preparation and then tried the case. Of course, Iraq didn't appear, but we still had to prove the claims. And ultimately, Judge Jackson issued judgments on behalf of each of the human shields, judgments that ranged in amount from as little as about 50 or 100,000 to as much as 1.75 million. They averaged about $500,000 per victim.
And the total was 95 million, is that right?
That's right. There were 180 victims.
180 victims that you represented in a class action lawsuit against Saddam Hussein and the country of Iraq.
Correct.
Right. So you win in court. But then you got to get your money. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, that was really, winning in court was the easy part, because there was never any real question about Saddam's liability. There were plenty of it was a matter of public record. Let's put it that way. Getting the money was a difficult process, because at that point there was no provision in U.S. law that gave the victims a right to collect against terrorist assets, against Iraq's assets, that were held right here in the United States in American banks. So we had to get a piece of legislation passed that would enable them to collect against those assets. And fortunately, we got that legislation enacted in November 2002. The banks then resisted, and initially the State Department resisted. Then we got the legislation passed. There was nothing they could do. But then the banks resisted, and they didn't want to turn over the money. And so we had a huge battle, and finally, literally, on March 25th, 2003, the State Department stepped in, because we had liens now at that point against that were basically holding up all of the Iraqi assets that had been blocked. And so the U.S. government said, well, if you release the liens, then we'll license the money to pay for the judgments. And so they sent the license to the banks, ordering them to release the funds.
Dan, what were your thoughts when you could see that the Bush administration, the State Department and the Bush administration, was blocking the payment to these American citizens that they were due, that the courts determined these people should be paid by the Iraqi government, but yet the Bush administration, they didn't want to give up that money?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was outrageous. I mean, it seems to me that there's no greater justice here. It's, the symmetry was so clear. These were American citizens who had been terrorized by a terrorist government, and they were seeking to collect against assets of that terrorist country. The rights were clear, and sometimes the justifications were perplexing. Like, you know, we need this money to negotiate against with terrorist states, when in fact it was the Bush administration's official policy that we don't negotiate against with terrorist states. So it was perplexing and maddening, but ultimately. Our arguments prevailed in the U.S. Congress.
So you won that case. You made, of course, as the lawyer representing 180 people with a judgment of a total of about $95 million, you made a nice chunk of change yourself for all your work on the case for over the however many years you worked on it.
It was back split with other lawyers, but yeah, I was the principal lawyer, and I made a nice bundle of change.
Yeah. Then what did you do with that money?
Well, what I did is I started a foundation called the International Lifeline Fund. You know, my basic view was that this was, you know, I had accumulated a certain degree of wealth, essentially because of these terrible human rights abuses that had been committed by the Saddam regime, and I didn't think it right, frankly, that I used that money to enrich myself. I mean, I thought that I deserved a little bit, but I turned around and used that money to start this foundation, which is focused on low-cost, high-impact interventions in sub-Saharan Africa that are essentially designed to bring about the greatest possible good for the least amount of money.
And tell us, what are some of the projects that the Lifeline Fund is engaged in right now?
Well, we've been engaged in projects in four different countries. Sudan, the Darfur region of Sudan, the northern Uganda. We have a significant project on the Somali border of Kenya, working with Somali refugees, and also we've done some work on the Burundi's and Congolese border of Tanzania. And we have essentially two major initiatives. The first initiative, the one that's sort of easy for people to wrap their hands around, is a clean water initiative, where essentially what we do is we go to remote villages where people are drinking from the most the disgusting, vile, stagnant pools, where kids are suffering from as a result from dysentery, intestinal worms, typhoid, and a host of other diseases that are in fact the number one killer of infants and children in Africa. And what we do is we essentially drill a borehole and produce a freshwater well. And we can do that for about $2,000 to $2,500, thereby bringing fresh water, fresh clean drinking water, to about 800 people on average. So for a cost of $3 a person, about the same cost that your listeners would pay to go to a restaurant and order a bottle of water, we can provide water for a suffering child for the next 5 to 10 years of their life. $3.
Amazing. And what's the other one?
The other initiative is a sustainable fuel technology initiative. Basically, life in the African village revolves very much around cooking, and in particular, cooking on an open fire, so that people are essentially cooking the same way that they've been cooking since the dawn of civilization, or even before civilization. Cooking in that manner creates a host of problems for human life and for the environment. A woman must spend, on average, about 3 hours a day collecting wood in areas that are in where wood is in short supply. It could be five or six hours a day collecting wood, plus another 3 hours a day or so cooking on an open fire, which obviously is not the most efficient means of cooking. When that same woman cooks in her hut, she'll breathe in toxic fumes from that fire. I've been in those huts, and you can stand there for about 20 or 30 seconds before your eyes start tearing and you start coughing, and all you can think about is escaping for the exit. In addition, you'll see a lot of kids throughout Africa that have these horrible burn injuries that they suffered when they were babies or young children that fell in the open fire. And then you've got the fact that when women go out and collect this wood, if they're in an insecure region, they're susceptible to rape and other forms of violence. And finally, the environmental problems of cooking on an open fire are huge. It doesn't seem like much, but actually a typical family will consume 10 kilograms, 25 pounds approximately, of wood every day. And over the course of the year, the typical family will consume 15 medium-sized trees.
Now, you've been there many times, and of course you work there. Is Africa, help us understand, as Americans who just, you know, Africa's not always on the front page, let's admit it, but is it on a break? I mean, are we looking at a potential Haiti on the whole continent?
That will happen to Africa, and when that does, I mean, I'm sure that people are aware, of course, of the kind of genocides that we've experienced in Rwanda, the mass slaughters in Darfur, the disease, the poverty that Africa has been suffering in this last century. Well, that will be nothing compared to what's going to happen 40 years from now if nothing is done to stop the deforestation. And you know, if nothing is done, the whole continent, not just Somalia, for instance, or places like Afghanistan, which of course are not in Africa, but we're going to have this whole continent is going to become a breeding ground for terrorists, a totally unstable region. So it's not only a matter of justice, which it very much is, but it's also a matter of our own security and the livelihoods and safety of our children, that we do something now to deal with this problem in Africa.
And of course, the Pentagon has definitely recognized this by creating an entire African command and separating that out of the European command, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that the U.S. government does realize is beginning to realize that Africa is going to become a terrible security issue for our country and for the entire developing world if we don't do something now to stem the tide of deforestation and to do something to bring some level of economic justice to that continent.
Yeah. But meanwhile, you have folks like, you know, the great powers of the world, I'm thinking of China especially, funding, you know, the quest for oil in Darfur and taking advantage of the situation for resources, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's to be expected, I guess, in this kind of, you know, geopolitical competition that we have. China is way ahead, I think, of our thinking in terms of Africa. They are getting themselves a huge foothold, not only with regard to oil, but even with regard to development. And ultimately, I think what they're trying to do is create a situation of African dependency on China. And you know, establish a strategic foothold there that will be used to their benefit in the future.
Dan Wolf is the founder and the executive director of the International Lifeline Fund. You can learn more online and give to help support the work that he is doing in Africa, he and his team there, at lifelinefund.org. Dan, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.